Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Gary Stewart with Conscious Connection. Today I'm interviewing an author, Sparrowheart, which happens to be a relative of mine who just published his first book. His first book is called Letters to the River, and it's a guide to a dream worth living by Sparrowheart. He's a wonderful person who's done vision quests. So the Letters to the River places the struggles and crisis we currently face personally, politically, morally, ecologically, And within the concept of a mythic and heroic journey. It takes a lot of courage to go out in the wilderness and really tune into nature in this modern age here. And it's just absolutely incredible, the insights that he's come up with. And fascinating how he weaves it into a really detail on so many levels. And I have him on the phone now, so let's speak to him and we'll get into it in depth. Hello, Sparrow, are you there?
Yeah, is this you, Gary?
Yes, it's Gary Stewart with Conscious Connection, and congratulations on your first day of being an author. I'm very excited to interview you tonight.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's really exciting to, you know, finally have the book in print.
Well, you've done so much work and research. Talk about research. It's been decades that you've led these vision quests and just really tuned into nature to a really deep level. Would you like to just tell our listeners a little bit about your experiences that led you to write the book here?
I've been leading vision quests now for 28 or so years. And in that process of leading vision quests, I was definitely first drawn to really explore my soul through connecting with nature, connecting with a force larger than ourselves. And so I've spent a lot of time and a lot of years when I was younger, certainly training with a lot of well-known medicine people, but, you know, over that course of time, I really realized that we as a culture have become almost totally disconnected from the land, from ourselves, from any kind of larger story that connects us to the grand forces of the earth.
Yes.
The real scheme
of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and we've basically grown up and lived in a mythology in which we pretty much separated ourselves from most of everything. I mean, not just from nature and the earth, but really from our own bodies, our hearts, our imaginations, and pretty much isolated in our rational mind and our heads and disconnected from the rest of creation. And that mythology is basically been at the root of a lot of our pain and a lot of the damage we've done to the earth and in ourselves and any sense of community. So,
Yes, very, very true. And it's great that you have the courage to connect to the natural world and be of such a great intelligence that you can communicate that most intimate level from your experiences to teach us. Because I often view nature as our teacher and we don't always listen. And I think Rachel Carson with Silent Spring after the introduction of DDT was the first one to alert us, hey, there's no birds anymore. Hey, there's no chirping. What do we add to the environment to silence it? So I really think we need to listen to what nature is telling us and connect to it at a very deep level. And I see a lot of the problems in urban society and modern humanity is we're so disconnected.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really sad. I mean, it's only a little exaggeration to say that certainly mostly what I learned in school and most of my educational life was, it was something like this. You know, what I was taught was, the point of life is to compete against everyone else and and beat them. And of course, in that situation, of course, 98% of the people lose. But and then if you're if you're one of the winners, what you get to do is buy more stuff.
Right.
And
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really we got to ask ourselves, come on, there has to be a bigger and a better story than that.
Absolutely. You know, and I feel the indigenous people had it right all along. The Native Americans lived in sacred unity and one with nature, and they were really in tune to the bigger forces, which I really feel this book shows the average white American that there is another path, and we can get back to the garden, which we've wandered so far from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in some sense, certainly the book comes out of my own story, which was, you know, as you well know, I, you know, I was a pretty smart and bright kid and got scholarships to some really elite schools and universities. And basically, you know, at the end of all that process, I realized all that training was just to really put on a tie and essentially do something soulless and exploit the earth. And I said, and my feeling was, I can't do it. I have to find a more soulful story than that to live. And I think we all
do. And that takes a lot of courage, because the metaphor is we plug into the mechanized system that humanity's created through capitalism, and for you to be in touch with your own nature at a deep level, even at that young age, knowing that that wasn't the path that you wanted to take, was actually the path that led to writing this book and having Letters to the River be your first book. And I find it very admirable, because so many people buy into the, I gotta, you know, have two homes, two color TVs, vacation home, I'm gonna make the payments on the BMW so I fit in and have the right suit on. And it's all in the bigger scheme of things rather meaningless. So it's I honor your courage to go out there and just follow your own natural impulses and create this whole career for yourself, and then take us on a journey through your writings.
Well, thank you. Yeah. It's been a long and rich journey, actually. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at the chapters. I wish I had more time to read it, where it's hot off the press today. I want you to have a good sound bite through Conscious Connections here. Are there any that stood out to you that you'd like to tell our listeners about to help either educate them or open them up to their own human nature that they carry inside and can learn from?
Well, I wanted to, you know, really, first of all, one thing I guess I wanted to share was why the title, you know?
Yes,
the title. The title is Letters to the River, you know, a guide to a dream worth living. And that phrase, Letters to the River, is there's really three levels to that. You know, the first level is, you know, how that title came about was, in the late 1990s, I was kind of early in my writing career. I had written a lot of articles for magazines, and I found myself really, again, you know, limited by the format. And I was sitting next to a river in New Mexico, and I decided to do some non-dominant handwriting, and so I put the pen in my right hand and just started writing and basically saying, why am I so frustrated with the form in which I'm writing? And then I would put the pen in my left hand and let my left hand write back. And when I did that, you know, writing with your non-dominant hand accesses, you know, different parts of your brain. I got a lot of really interesting information about, you know, the way I really wanted to write and what to me felt so limiting about writing for magazines, which was really writing for a certain market. And then and then after about an hour of doing this practice, you know, I said, I again put the pen in my right hand and wrote out wrote the question, well, this is fantastic information, but what do I do about it? And then I put the pen back in my left hand, and out of my left hand it said, right to the river.
Oh, wow.
Right to the river. And what that meant to me is, don't write to an audience, don't write to an editor, don't write to some magazine's requirement. Sit here right now and write to that river. And so it started me on a process that who I was speaking to in the writing was, you know, the natural world, the spirit. And so the book kind of had its birth in that moment when my left hand said, right to the river. And so so there's, I mean, that's the literal answer of why that title came about. But as I would do this practice of writing to the river, it moved me into a much different place, because you know, as I continued to write, and I would generally write at least these lyrical pieces that would start, "Dear River" or "Dear Spirits of the Mountains." To me, I found that, you know, the river is like a metaphor. You know, when we look at when I would start to really examine that metaphor of a river, it's just like it encompassed a lot more than just a simple noun. You know, it encompassed a whole cycle of, you know, the sun shines on the ocean, evaporation comes to the sky, up to the sky, it condenses into clouds, rain falls on the mountain, and then this whole trickle process comes down and it eventually runs back out into the ocean again. So, So the river really was a metaphor for, one, this grand cycle, but it was a grand cycle that went through many forms. You know, the individual droplet falling on the mountain is, in some sense, that's like our individual separated consciousness. And then as these droplets would come together and join together, you know, the river represented this sense of changing boundaries, changing forms. It could be, you know, frothing, rapid, placid,
right.
But then the whole journey was back to the ocean, this sense of joining again into the ocean. And so it in some sense represented our spiritual journey, you know, being a single drop falling in the mountains, our individual consciousness eventually merging into the ocean, that sense of spiritual oneness. And so
and it could also be considered the ocean is the great mystery. It really has that large about it and that completeness where everything's included and everything flows into it, but yet it's an unknown destination too. So there's just so many beautiful metaphors. It's just absolutely wonderful. And I'd like for also our listeners who don't know what a vision quest is, how many people would you take out on that part of the portion, separate from your own, let's say, mystical journey with nature? And would you take other people on these journeys so they could connect deeper inside themselves and have that natural experience as a leader?
Oh, sure, yeah. I've been leading Vision Quest since 1986. And in the way that, I mean, for people who are unfamiliar with what a Vision Quest is, let me just say it usually involves a few elements. It involves being alone, you know, so it involves solitude. It involves being in nature, and so most of the Vision Quests I lead are in wilderness areas, so it solitude, nature, and it involves fasting. So it's people drink water and they don't eat. And so, you know, some people have this, oh my God, who would do that? And the obvious answer is, who would do that? Christ, Buddha, Moses, Black Elk, Muhammad.
Right, exactly.
Kind of litany of Yeah, virtually all the major world religions were actually started by some creature, some being who initially did a vision quest. So Buddha went into the forest and he fasted under the Bodhi tree. Moses went up on Mount Sinai and he fasted and prayed. Muhammad went into a cave and fasted and had a vision. So these were all vision quests. So in the way that I lead vision quests in the modern era is it's an 11-day program. And in the first 4 days are involved with preparation. There's certainly a lot of teaching and instruction about various the tradition of the vision quest, the parts of the rite of passage, and the myth of the heroic journey. Teaching about the physical plane, what to expect from fasting, from being alone in nature, how to deal with anything that people might be concerned with, fears about flora, fauna, staying dry if there's rain, but basically a lot of teaching about ritual and ceremony, different ways that people can actually go on a quest and really deal with the issues of in their life, whether it's an issue of what's my purpose and direction, or whether it's an issue of how do I free myself from habits or patterns in my psyche that are draining my energy and diminishing my life. So there's a lot of teaching about ritual and ceremony. And so the first 4 days are really a lot of teaching and then and instruction, and then the second 4 days, the people actually go out on solo. They've found their own place in the wilderness. They'll be spending the next 4 days and nights, and so they spend that time out there fasting. And then the last 3 days, the people return, and we sit in circle, and these are all small groups, and the average size is probably from 6 to 8. I never take more than 8 at a time. And so when people come back, they tell the story of their solo time about what happened, what spoke to them, insights they had, dreams that came to them, and the last 3 days are really going into those stories and really pulling out what it means in terms of the person's intent and purpose in coming on the quest, and how to bring those teachings or those commitments or those back to their daily life, so that they can live more connected to this greater sense of themselves. So, I mean, that's the gist of what the Vision Quest is.
Now, did you find that what happened with them on the Vision Quest helped you write in the book, or was the book here more from your just individual Vision Quest?
The book, I think, comes much more from my own individual Vision Quest. Mm-hmm. I've been leading Vision Quest now for, as I said, 27 years, but I did my first Vision Quest in 1980 in the Black Hills, and I've done a Vision Quest of my own every year. So I've done at this point like 33 Vision Quests of my own. So that process of going into nature, of opening myself, learning how to, speak and read and listen to the voice of the earth is something I've really developed in myself, and learning how to relate to the earth as father, mother, teacher, friend, ally. That's been just a huge part of my own journey. And I think the book Letters to the River probably comes out of my own journey more than out of leading Vision Quests.
Right.
But there's a big overlap.
Yeah, to know what
there's a big overlap because, you know, the fact I'm leading Vision Quest, that comes out of my own journey too.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You know, and one thing I find interesting is you've done so many different ecological landscapes between the Amazon, forests, canyon, deserts of Mexico. I know you've done some, I think it's Anza Borrega in outside of San Diego. Do you notice mm-hmm. that the messages are different depending on the environment that you're doing your own personal vision quest in? Does nature sing you a different song, so to speak, if you're in a desert environment or a jungle environment, or is it pretty consistent just with, like, one natural voice communicating in all different styles of ecosystem?
Well, I think the honest answer is to say yes and mm-hmm. no. Because there's something that is consistent in every environment, and yet there's something that's different in every environment. And the way I would put that is, you know, going back to the 60s, I remember, you know, this in
the other
60s, 60s. When,
yeah.
the 1960s,
yeah, I know.
When I remember one of the first things they discovered about people who took LSD was they said that 95% of what happened in an LSD experience was due to two factors, and they were called set and setting. And mm-hmm. set was the whole collection of purposes and motivations you were taking the LSD for. So it made a big difference whether you were taking it to, you know, discover your inner life or go to a party. It made a huge difference. And the
right.
And so that was the set, and setting was about the environment you took it in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same is basically true on a vision quest, where most people who do a vision quest go because there's certain issues they want to address, whether it's about purpose and direction in their life or about kind of freeing themselves from certain habits. So what I say is that the set or the purposes you'd be doing a quest for would be the same no matter where you did it.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
then you do it in a different setting. You know, when I lead quests in the Northeast, in Vermont, and in, you know, in
mm-hmm.
Death Valley and in New Mexico. And so, yeah, the settings vary a lot. And so in one environment, like, say, in Vermont, there's a lot of energy of, you might say, earth and water, a lot of that energy. Mm. And whereas in some landscape like Death Valley, where it's kind of vast and stark, there's a lot of fire and air energy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's almost like it's a co-creation between the person meeting the spirit of nature. So,
mm-hmm.
So in that sense, yeah, doing it in a different environment means that the song being sung by nature is different. But, you know, generally your purposes for doing a quest would probably be the same no matter where you did it. So it's almost like a duet where it's a duet, but where one part of that duet will be the same no matter what, and the other voice in the duet will be different depending on where you do it. So it's really a yes and no answer about, you know, the...
Excellent. Well, the paradoxes of life are great, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to ask, do you feel, I'm a big ecologist, and do you feel that Earth is feeling the pain of the degradation and the invasion, whether it's of fracking, pollution, toxins, or is it so steadfast and deep, like the natural world being much bigger than man, like man is like an annoying mosquito or a flea on a dog, so to speak? Do you find nature's reacting to human activity? Because we're just really fouling so much here. Do you find that Earth speaks to that on your personal vision quest or in different locations, like the Amazon being deforested? And
Well, you know, I guess what I mean, we all know, the science tells us that we're damaging
right.
the Earth. I mean, that's like can't be argued by
mm-hmm.
anyone. But, you know, But I think the thing, I think that the way that most of us react, we think, oh, we're damaging the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're damaging ourselves. You know, it's just that the earth is, you know, our mother, our father. It's the
yes.
earth is what creates us. I mean, the fact that, you know, in the industrialized nations, the number of people suffering from, you know, depression, attention deficit,
thousands. Yes.
I mean, mm-hmm. it's just like, the damage to the earth and the pain and the suffering of the human psyche, they're not isolated from each other. It's like
right.
the yin and the yang of the way we live.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful teacher who lives in New Mexico named Martine Prechtel, and I remember once speaking to him, and one of the things he said kind of I think really expressed that connection well. He was talking about the kind of loss of indigenous cultures as tribes were destroyed or they were moved off their land for, you know, for oil or mineral exploration. And of course there can be a lot of political outrage about, oh, we're doing this awful thing to these indigenous people. And then there'll be campaigns and, you know, there'll be some response and it'll be in the headlines a little bit and then it'll disappear.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Martine said is that we will never fully stand up for the rights of indigenous people until we realize that there's an indigenous person living in every single one of us. And
mm-hmm.
the culture is just as committed to rubbing that one out as it is to,
right.
you know,
right.
to exploiting those tribes, because
right, right, extremely
the wild and natural person in each of us has to be tamed, domesticated, and suppressed,
mm-hmm.
so that we become the good consumers that the culture
mm-hmm.
demands we be. So
yeah,
there's
absolutely.
There has to be a wound to our soul in order for us to, to enroll in the, the cultural story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. We've barely scratched the surface here. So I'd like people to know how to contact you, too. We have a couple minutes left here. And I definitely want to finish the book here and invite you back for a second layer after I finish the book, maybe around the holiday season, just to...
Okay.
So much to speak about here. We've just barely scratched the surface. And what is the best way for people to purchase the book here? At Amazon.com?
Well, that's certainly one way. You can go on Amazon and, you know, under books, type in Letters to the River, and it'll take you to that page. Or a second, and just as good a way, is to just go on my website. And my website is www.questforvision.com, all one word, questforvision.com. And that website has, you know, a bunch of pages, many of them on my vision quest, but it also has a book page describing the book with all the reviews of it and a button, a link that will take you right to the Amazon page.
Okay, excellent. So, well, I'll definitely put that on our link here to our interview so people have that, Quest for Vision. So if they didn't write it down now, they'll be able to see it on my social networks that we'll post in about 10 minutes. We just have a couple minutes left, and it's just been not even that, 60 seconds, actually. And it's been wonderful to speak to you about this, and I look forward to a continued discussion after I complete the book to go in depth here after I'm so inspired by everything you've seen and done. It's just very impressive. And do you like people to contact you through email as well?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah.
Sparrow@together.net. Great. I'll
yep.
put that on the link that I'm going to publish in just a couple of minutes. Well, this has mm-hmm. been Gary Stewart with Conscious Connection interviewing Sparrowheart in his new book that's just out today, Letters to the River, A Guide to a Dream Worth Living, which we all definitely need. I can't thank you enough for doing this, and I will have this posted on social networks in minutes. So thank you very much, and blessings with the sales of the book, and I'll put all the links for them to contact you and get the book. And it's just been an absolute honor and pleasure, Sparrow.
Hi. Well, thank you, Gary. It's a real treat to speak with you, and thanks for posting it on the networks.
Absolutely. We'll get it out there. Thank you. Namaste.
All right. Namaste to you. Take care
okay,
now.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.